Okay, Mr. Representative Leonard, for the comments, that's in control.
Representative Leonard got some of what I was going to say. The minimum salary we've set for them is very minimal. A lot of these people have a great deal of experience, and they really are heroes when they come in suddenly to take over for a teacher that can't continue for some reason or another. And they get paid less than any average salary of a beginning teacher. So their salary level, the minimum we set. Now, sometimes they're paid more than the minimum, but not very often. Usually the minimum salary we set is what they're paid. And it's not, it's certainly a modest salary for people who really do an important job.
So, how do they get paid?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I was just affirming what Senator Crowe was saying, that most school districts do adopt the minimum that is provided for in statute, and that is 85% of the average statewide salary for beginning teachers with a bachelor's degree. And in some cases, in very few cases, there are schools that once those substitute teachers go past 10 days, their beginning salary on which the pay for over 10 days is calculated falls below 85% of the statewide average, and that's why this bill was introduced, so that they would at least get paid what they get paid for the first 10 days and not take a cut in pay simply because they stay past 10 days.
Mm-hmm. And, Mr. Chair, can staff clarify for us the benefits issue? My recollection was they do not get benefits due to the no.
That's correct. They do not get the benefit package that a full-time teacher would get.
Okay. Further questions or comments? Are there any no votes on House Bill 2619? Seeing none and hearing none, House Bill 2619 has passed. Budget bills previously reported out, Senate Bill 5520, the Department of Justice, Senator Hans.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, members, Senate Bill 5520 is the budget bill for the Department of Justice. It's been through this committee once, went to the floor of the Senate and passed, back over to the House, and then was sent back down the Ways and Means. The only action the subcommittee did was to reduce the Department's general fund by $569,898, or a 4% of the total, and then backfilled with other funds expenditure limitations with a like amount. And the net effect is that they're going to receive money from the tobacco tax settlement legal fees of an estimated $600,000. What this does is allow us to back outside of much a general fund and insert the legal fees collection from the tobacco tax settlement. There is no opposition. The Attorney General supports it. And we would move to send it back out to the House with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Hannon. Any comments? Questions? Are there any no votes on Senate Bill 5520?
I was a no vote before, so I'm here a no vote.
Okay, let the record show that even though we saved another $500,000, that Senator Yee is still on hold. Representative Schrader.
Actually, I'm still in no vote because I think we can save more money in the other fund category than we have today.
Okay, Representative Webster.
Question for Senator Yee, is there a level at which you'd be a yes vote?
Work on it.
Well, the Attorney General fee is increasing much more than last time. It was, what, $69 last year?
$79.
Now it is $90. So this is a 15% increase?
Well, it's a significant increase.
And it affects all agencies.
Right.
And I hear that maybe there is more efficiency they can achieve in the department before they can have such a significant increase.
I do have a question.
Okay. Well, Representative Weston, chair of the committee.
I was going to, I share your initial concern, Senator Yee. This is not something that we in the committee took lightly. We worked very hard with the department. I want to compliment the department on a very collaborative attitude. And in fact, when we looked at it and we felt we couldn't do any more, we brought it through this body and went off to the Senate, and all of us, many of us, were just uncomfortable with the size of the fee increase. We brought it back to LFO and looked at it again. And we can sit up here and we can pat ourselves on the back and call ourselves great budget cutters, you know, at the expense of good public policy. And after we looked at it again, we decided, no, it was better public policy to allow the larger increase. And this is not something that we did lightly or cavalierly. This is something that, was looked at twice very thoroughly. And again, I want to compliment the department, and we looked at it in their understanding, their cooperation in taking the second $580,000. I want to point out that, and I think we protected them pretty well in the budget notes and the budget narrative, that this could leave the Consumer Protection and Fraud Division short next biennium if we don't address that in additional funding next biennium. But this is not a budget, fellow members, that was rushed or cursorily brushed through. I mean, this was looked at very, very thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I was going to ask a question, but I answered my own question. We did have a concern, and we heard the concern of the members here on fall and the members in sub about the increase in the fee. When we worked the budget the first time, the number of people indicated being upset about the going from 79, and they had originally asked for 92, and we had worked them down to $90. So after it had come back from the Senate floor, as Representative Lesman said, we did try very hard to see if we could further reduce the Attorney General's fees from 90 down to, hopefully 89. And frankly, we just weren't able to do that. And the big workload driver for the Attorney General and for many other branches of our government, the judicial branch, and also in our indigent defense, the big drivers are the workloads for criminal appeals. And so one other difference we did do in this budget is we did add a budget note, it's on your back page, that speaks to having our legal experts, our Department of Justice and the judicial branch, look in the interim for ways to, and maybe come back to us with a proposal for changing the statute next biennium, ways to reduce the number and cost of appeals. Without violating a defendant's constitutional rights. And I think that's very important. They are the legal experts, and they could help us in this. We do allow more appeals than are required by federal law, and so there are some ways we could probably reduce our costs, and we've asked them to do that. So perhaps we won't be looking next time if they're successful in finding ways to reduce those appeals, perhaps we won't be looking at another giant increase in their fee. So just so everyone keeps that in mind, next session we should be looking for some ways to reduce criminal appeal.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, for your explanation. Any further questions, Senator Yee?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say I do appreciate the effort the committee putting scrutinizing the budget. And the shifting of funds this time so we can use less general funds. And I appreciate that. But I just feel very concerned about the increase in attorney general's fees and the amount of 15% increase and the FTE increase in 15%. At least this is about 159 position increase. So my no vote is my expression of concern and frustration. Maybe other departments can request less attorney general use. Is there any way they can hire more in-house attorneys, get all the work prepared, so there'll be less time demand on attorney general's part?
Well, we're working, Senator Yee, as the co-chair mentioned, we are working on that in DAF. We have a budget known also on the DAF budget in regards to it. We're trying to get at the very issue that you're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Package.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mm-hmm. To expand on that, we've asked that there be gatekeepers at each agency, and the DAF budget has that in it. So every time an agency turns around, they're not picking up the phone to ask for Attorney General's advice, and that they have to go through a gatekeeper in each department. And that was a concern of ours. In fact, that was a concern partially from the department, from the Attorney General's office, was that you know, they had some agencies who they have had problems with. They've tried to deal with it internally. Now we're asking GAAP to come in and look at that on that basis. And we hope that that will reduce some of the costs for attorney general fees in the future and keep the budget down as much.
Thank you. Representative Wessel.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. In addressing Senator Yee's concern about FTE, we too shared that concern. And one of the things that we must recognize on this committee is that our Department of Justice, the attorneys in our Department of Justice, handle three times the caseload that our surrounding states, you know, counterpart Department of Justice's handle. I mean, they're really quite, you know, exceptional in the amount of work they get out compared to our other states. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the other states aren't doing a good job and that we're, you know, doing exceptional work. I mean, maybe someplace in the middle is the truth of that statement, but the crux of the matter is, and part of the reason for the FTE increase is that, quite frankly, we hire government attorneys a heck of a lot cheaper than if we have to go out on the street and hire private attorneys, and that's what the department has had to do. So we're actually saving money employing these additional FTE. And it's one of those catch-22s where, you know, we're not going to win. Let me make a larger comment. We just heard the Crime Commission budget and our public safety sub, and without editorializing too much, one of the things that they really haven't done in the past was perform their statutorial obligation with regard to, you know, analyzing a long-term, comprehensive, compatible, coordinated justice system in this state. I mean, everything from the arrest to the public defenders, the prosecutors, the judges, and the incarceration policies. And we have strongly recommended to them through budget notes and other things, which you'll be seeing when the budget gets to this committee, that we finally really sit down and take a look at an integrated justice system. That's something we don't have now, Senator Yee. It's something that you are correctly responding to. Wait a minute, I'm concerned about this. And I think we could have more justice for less money if we take a better look at that. And that's one of the things I hope to be doing in the interim.
Okay, Representative Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I was among those members in this body that expressed my concern originally about the amount of the increase and had conversations with Co-Chair Lewis about that. But I appreciate the effort that has been done. I think the budget note and looking at how we can reduce the cost of appeals is good. I think that the doorkeeper concept that Representative Patridge talked about is also important. I just make one other comment that I think it is important for us to strike a balance, that we shouldn't go so far about saying the only purpose is to reduce the Attorney General's costs and have that be the only purpose, because we need to be careful that we are, in fact, encouraging agencies to be aware of possible suits and possible legal liability, and we don't want to be so negative about any use of the Attorney General's staff that we ignore liability items. And that's why I think the doorkeeper concept is really good, because that way they can determine when this is a real risk and when it's not. But I think we need to do a balance, and I appreciate the work of the committee, and I'm willing to vote yes.
Any further comments? I think we have a roll call vote. Roll call vote on Senate Bill 5520, Department of Justice.
Yes.
Hi.
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 Hi. Hi.
Hey.
No.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. Hi. 5520, Department of Justice, is passed. Next, Senate Bill 5536, Secretary of State, Senator Trump.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. As you said, Senate Bill 5536 is budget for the Secretary of State. We've already dealt with this and passed this body before. Went to the floor of the Senate and then was called back on the recommendation of legislative council because there's a small addition that had to be made for explaining the budget. We needed to add for the biennium beginning July 1, 1999, through the language in the bill. And so it brought back subcommittee. We made that amendment. We sent it back to you. Hopefully you will approve it.
Thank you, Senator Trout. Any questions, comments? Representative.
Great. Well, why did I forget, and we probably discussed this before, but why was the Secretary of State pulled the packages 143 and 145?
Well, that's been discussed earlier, and I'll have to talk about it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Secretary of State was willing to pull packages 143 and 145. 143, I believe, is the they had intended to incorporate in their base budget technology. They decided to voluntarily withdraw that. It's included to SNS, the existing SNS. 145 was a request to fund a voter registration system, a centralized voter registration system. The Secretary of State would do that. There's a substantive bill introduced that would statutorily require the Secretary of State to have implement a centralized voter system, voter registration system. He felt that was the place to deal with the money there. Okay. Further questions? Are there any no votes in the Secretary of State's budget? Hearing none and seeing none, Senate Bill 5536, Secretary of State, has passed. Madam Co-Chair, you have any comments?
No, I just thank the subcommittees. You all are doing an excellent job on getting your 4% reduction. We don't always hit exactly 4%, but we're getting good reductions and still ending up with good budgets that protect programs and services. And I thank all the full and subcommittee members for their work.
Thank you. Everyone was here.
Great.
Immediately. Okay, the Transportation Committee will meet immediately.
Yes, sir.
And it's an area that government simply doesn't need to go. The reasonable people, pharmacists of conscience can talk to their employers. They can work these arrangements out with their employers. They don't need the state legislature to bail them out.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I would go back to what someone smarter than I said, that our conscience is our most sacred property. And if we can facilitate to that with bills like this, then I think it's our responsibility to do that, to guard and to protect that. We're not talking about denying people the ability to have access to these drugs. We're simply saying that there may be some places that you can't get them. And I have the right to buy Goodyear tires, but I can't buy them at Sears. I just have to go someplace else to get them. And if I want these drugs, then there are places I can go to have access to them. I mean, our whole marketplace is filled like that. So if it's going to facilitate and protect the conscience of individuals to be able to do this, then I think it's entirely appropriate that we do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess to follow up with Representative Perry, I'll follow up with you as to how this would work. If you went to a pharmacy and one time you get the prescription filled, you go back to the same pharmacy and for whatever reason that pharmacist, he or she, has this conscience of objection as to, what inconvenience is that going to be for the store as well as for the customer? I do have a question here. My review of looking at the dashboard on page 2, starting in the subsection 7, line 12, it sets up what is going to be the immunity for someone that refuses to fill. I don't see any distinction, and my review of the bill, I'm wondering if counsel could help me. Point me to where a person would not be receiving that immunity if they had failed to do the referral.
Something I can help you with that one.
Mr.
Chair, I think
I will not be able to support the A4s, not that I could in the first place, but clearly I won't be able to support them, where we're going to basically give outright immunity to a pharmacist who not only refuses to do it, but fails to do the referral, based on my review of the A4s.
All right. I've mentioned that parentheticus as a referral is the duty of the owner or operator of the pharmacy at that point, according to the statute. I'd also indicate in the discussion as to the question as to subsection 5 of section 2 that it's fairly clear to me that the simple operating procedure would be that the pharmacist says, I don't want to fill these kinds of prescriptions because they can be used for these kinds of purposes. It doesn't matter to the pharmacist or the owner or operator whether or not they will be used for those purposes, and then simply a matter of soliciting the medications that are covered by the refusal, and then you don't have to get into what they're being used for. So there's some simple common sense ways of implementing it. I recognize that in any given complex area we can come up with a number of what ifs and questions, but I think the plain words of this set of amendments are sufficient to do the task for folks of good faith and common sense who are trying to exercise a conscience clause. I do find it somewhat pleasant that some of us can be advocating for worker rights as opposed to corporate and employer rights in this conscience area. All right, the motion is in front of us to adopt the A4 amendment. We'll call the roll on that.
No. Aye.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Aye. The motion is carried. Representative Gianella, do you also move the bill to the floor with a due pass as amended?
Yes.
All right, we have that motion in front of us.
Chair,
Representative Johnson.
I just want clarification. I do see that we have a summary here, and it does have, it looks like a fiscal statement issued, and it does have a meeting date of 5/27. I'm wondering if we actually have the fiscal statement for this bill before it can be moved to the floor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zansky, I think that there was one that was provided to the original committee that this bill went in front of, and at this point I have not received one, especially for the A4 amendments, no, which were received, I think, late yesterday.
Mr. Chair, I will be objecting on procedural grounds that this bill cannot be moved to the floor without having a fiscal impact statement issued on the A4s.
All right. I would note that the A4s, if anything, narrowed the bill rather than broad the bill, because the fiscal impact would be narrower rather than broader, so that we're still empowered to send it to the floor, as was the previous committee. If the A4s broadened the bill, that would create an issue of fiscal impact statement.
Mr. Chair, I'm asking that we have the Chief Clerk come in, because my understanding is she addressed this before this committee on another bill, that we had to have a fiscal on any measures that are going to the floor. This is from what Council said, we do not have that at this point.
Is that correct, Mr. Wirt? We don't have it at this point?
At this point, we do not have it regarding the A4s. I can check and see if there is any documentation regarding the original bill. I do not know that that in itself would be dispositive.
Distributed on the floor. Mm-hmm. All right, what we'll do is we'll just recess the work session on Hospital 2010, subject to reinstituting the work session sometime today, and we'll check out the fiscal impact on that. The motion is pending. We'll move on to Representative King. Which bill were you here on? All right.
482.
And we'll move into work session on Senate Bill 482 and Representative King. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's take a look at them. Council, why don't you bring us up to speed?
Mr. Chairman, the committee has to support the A3 amendments and the A4 amendments. What the A3 amendments do is to provide that the liquidated damages, which are covered in Section 1 of the bill, instead of simply being any amount of $1,000, are instead an amount not less than $500 but not more than $1,000. There will be a range then between $500 and $1,000 for the liquidated damages. The other thing that the A3 amendments do is to delete the enhanced penalty under the criminal harassment statute, which in the original bill took it up to a Class A misdemeanor. The A3 amendments would simply remove that portion from the bill. The A4 amendments do the same thing as the A3 as to the liquidated damages portion, with $500 to $1,000 as the range. What the A4 amendments do in regard to the criminal harassment statute is to specify that in order for the enhanced harassment penalty to occur, that the offense of physical contact must be made during a sports event, immediately before or after a sports event at which the victim serves as a sports official. And that is to eliminate the possibility of, for example, an unrelated situation, unrelated to a sports event, where the victim simply happened to be a sports official.
This is King. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Al King, District 44. And I have had a chance to read the amendments presented and find them suitable, and appreciate the crafting of that.
And you understand that they create a little bit more of a nexus as to the connection between the sports activity and the sports official and the enhancement.
That's correct. I think that's valuable.
All right. Person was asking.
Sure. We're working with just the A4s at this point.
Apparently that's what we're working with. Do we have any others?
Well, we have the A3s before us, Mr. Chairman, as well. The committee could choose between the two.
Those are from before.
No, they were requested at the same time, Mr. Chairman.
For some reason, I don't have my...
No, that's not it. Well, they may not...
Somebody's working from them, but I'm not, so I'd like to see them.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I just wonder if we ever answered the question that all these things are... violations of existing laws and are apparently not being pursued, and why do we think that these new laws are going to make a difference if we're not enforcing the other laws?
President King, would you like to answer that question?
In the -4 amendments on page 2, line 3, there's an item 5 that says notwithstanding section 3 of this subsection, harassment is a Class A misdemeanor. And, by making something a Class A misdemeanor, it really allows the police authorities to be able to come to an event, if there is, substantial, threatening activity, occurring there. And I think that's what creates the impression that we need to have to be able to take that kind of behavior out of the sports event, give the not only the authority, but also the demonstration to public will that that's not okay. And I think that would be an event that would make an impression for many years.
My staff must have thought that I was too sleepy. Just sure to follow. Let me clarify something. You do have some choices here, Representative King. And I'm glad the A3s were brought up, because I suggested before, now that I'm smelling my coffee and waking up and smelling the coffee, that the A3s were developed to address the precise concern Representative Sinceri raised, which is why keep enhancing the status of the offense in the criminal side if nothing's being done. But the A3s say, well, let's really talk about the civil side, because this could allow for someone to go after somebody for a quick penalty civilly. They don't have to go through the prosecuting attorney, and it doesn't do the criminal law side, but it says, and it represents something else that Representative Vansky suggested, that there be a range for the liquidated damages from $500 to $1,000. So the A3 say, forget the enhancement of the criminal penalty, but allow someone to seek, in effect, a civil penalty of liquidated damages, and not just $1,000, but $500 to $1,000 is the stated range. So if someone's offensive enough to have committed this conduct, sports officials could have someone who routinely starts suing these people and hitting them and getting a judge to award $500 to $1,000 in penalties. That's the idea, at least, behind the A3. Representative Bowman?
Mr. Chair, I just have to ask, under current law, can't you civilly take somebody to court right now? If there's
actual damages, economic damages and non-economic damages, but unless there's a statute that establishes liquidated damages, that's almost a form of penalty when it's created there. It's damages for your trouble, and you don't have to prove it, and the judge can really say, I'll give you $750 or $1,000. It's a type of penalty is what it really is.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
Sure.
For me, that's really the issue. I think we do need to make sure that people who are attacking sports officials are prosecuted under current law. I guess the issue for me is I'm trying to understand why, because I was attacked as a sports official, I should go to court and walk out with $1,000. Or
Select Committee on Ways and Means, full committee meeting, Friday, May 7th, 1999, hearing room F, 8 a.m.
Call the full Ways and Means Committee to order. Are any House members out there?
Mr. Co-Chair, I believe that based on a prior arrangement and understanding, I owe you a milkshake, sir.
Yes, I beat you down here.
You did.
Right. Well, I'm a lot faster, you and younger.
What flavor?
Chocolate.
We did not specify. Thank you for bringing that up.
Harsh drink is a good flavor, too. Okay, let's make an order. Roll in here. I think we've got about seven items today. Okay, first item up to House Bill 5056, Oregon Public Broadcasting, Representative Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oregon Public Broadcasting. House Bill 5056 is the state's grant for OPD. The bill comes from the General Government Subcommittee. OPD is a private, nonprofit educational and public broadcasting network serving Oregon through non-commercial public television and public radio stations. OPD also maintains the statewide transmission system that serves as the state's emergency alert system backbone. The 1993 Legislative Assembly privatized OPD and provided for a supplemental grant to the Department of Administrative Services. The committee recommends a grant of $3,350,509 general fund, which is increased 2.8% from the 97-99 legislatively adopted budget. This is the current service level and is the same amount the governor recommended. The amount funds part of OPD's educational programming and part of its cost to maintain the emergency alert transmission system. Subcommittee recommends passage of that bill.
Thank you, Representative Leonard. Are there any questions, comments, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Ferriero.
I will turn your yield to a question.
No, I won't.
Here goes the grand high school boys again.
The carrier will be.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I just wondered what programming slots I could tune into the Rush Limbaugh show on the OPD radio broadcast.
That would be 6:20 on your AM dial, Senator Ferriero, when you're driving to the great Willamette Valley.
Thank you for that question. Any further questions, comments, any no votes? Hearing none and seeing none, House Bill 5056 is passed. Senate Bill 5501, Commission for the Blind, Representative Ross. Representative Ross is not here. Would you carry that? Are you on that committee? Who's on that committee? Yes, right. Let's have somebody on the committee. Wesley, you're a little bit eager. Already lost the milkshake. Senator Kutub.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senate Bill 5501 is the budget bill for the Commission for the Blind. The Commission provides vocational rehabilitation and independent living services to blind persons. The agency is funded with federal 1973 Rehabilitation Act funds, a variety of other funds, and general funds. Other fund revenue sources include Social Security reimbursement, sales income from the Industries for the Blind program, cooperative service agreements with school districts and other state agencies, and donations and bequest income. General fund and other funds are used to match Federal Rehabilitation Act funds. The budget for the Commission on the Blind for the Blind is about $11.5 million and includes about $1.4 million of general funds, $25,215 less than the governor's recommended budget. The budget includes $15,921 reduction in the other funds, the result of two budgetary changes. A technical adjustment that reduces other funds by $87,195 and increases federal funds BioLife amount and the addition of $71,274 of interest and investment income from agencies' bequests and donation funds. This additional interest and investment income is split evenly between the older blind program and the vocational rehabilitation program. The agency is directed to use the additional revenue for the vocational program to match any available federal Rehabilitation Act funds. The budget report includes a budget note that recommends that the Joint Legislative Audit Committee conduct an audit of the agency and directs the agency to present a plan to the Emergency Board on how the agency's services would be expanded with additional vocational service funds. The plan is to be developed cooperatively with the Department of Human Resources and the Department of Education. We urge passage.
Thank you, Senator Cusack.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Roth.
I thank the chair of the subcommittee for carrying my bill since my parking place was blocked in the basement and I couldn't get in. However, I do feel that this budget is an important budget, and I think that the request for a plan before the additional money is allocated is very wise. I did have a meeting yesterday with the director and with the chair of their commission and stressed the importance of a quality plan for the e-board before this money is released, and I would urge that staff and the e-board look carefully at their plan because we have asked them to make a serious attempt to outline exactly how they're going to spend the money. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ross. Any further questions, comments? Are there any no votes on the Commission for the Blind? Okay, it's Senate Bill 5501 is Senate Bill 5516, Department of Geology and Mineral Industry, Senator Ferry O'Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 5516 is the budget bill for GOGAMI, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industry. It comes with unanimous approval from Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee. The committee felt this was an extremely important budget for those of us who live in geologically active or hazardous areas. The department gathers data, maps, identifies potential hazards in the Oregon's geologically active zones resulting from tsunamis, landslides, and earthquakes. In addition, they also regulate state surface mining. The approved budget continues all agency programs. The subcommittee strongly committed to this agency and its performance. In reviewing their budget, we determined a 2% reduction in services and supplies is more appropriate than the standard 4% reduction. In addition, the subcommittee recommends the appropriation of emergency board $65,185 for service and supplies until the agency demonstrates a plan to use these funds. Package 101 provided $250,000 general funds for a coastal field office and a one-time employee. And the purpose of this package is for hazard identification, mapping, and public education of coastal areas, particularly with regard to landslides and tsunami issues. Understanding the general fund constraints, but realizing the importance of the package, the subcommittee approved the package, but provided only $1 in general fund application. The agency will need to finance this package from within their current service level, or if there are any add-backs or resources are identified that in the future, the subcommittee sees this package as a high priority and recommends it for your consideration. The subcommittee urges your unanimous support for Senate Bill 5516.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm glad that the subcommittee saw fit to give some special consideration to coastal problems. I think from what I'm hearing from experts, they believe that the possibilities of earthquakes and tsunamis and things like that are real possibility into the future, and those could be quite severe. And so I'm hoping that we can have the kind of expertise there that will be most helpful. Funding it with $1 and asking them to find the money internally, I think, is a real problem for them. And I would hope that we can find additional funding so that position can be adequately funded.
Okay, thank you, Senator Cho. Senator Perez.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cho, the committee felt very strongly that this is a worthwhile program. The current services provided by GOGAMI in this area consist largely of education, information publishing, brochures, orientation,
evacuation funds and the like for those kinds of efforts. It's a fairly extensive program now. The additional person, full-time FTE at the coast was an optional package that the budget would have put forward. There's a recognition that as we learn more about the potential for subduction earthquakes and tsunamis, the learning curve and the need curve have identified that we probably do need to move in this direction. Nobody could give us any kind of a time scale about the need. We probably have needed this person for the last 100 years and haven't known it. And again, if there's an add-back opportunity, that would be something that we would like to see the committee consider.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Representative Messer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to support that line of thinking, that the need on the coastal areas all along the coast, but particularly down the south coast, where they have identified as the largest, most risky area of the state, I guess, one way to put it. The communities simply need, for safety reasons, need to know what to expect and how it would impact the area should we have a tsunami or a major earthquake, and so that they can, over time, build in the emergencies and the programs to deal with the damage and move the population. So, again, I would urge us as a committee and as the Ways and Means Committee to, if we are able to add backs, that this is one position that makes an awful lot of sense. It would be a position that would cover the entire coast, and we have, I think there's three areas, Walport's another one, that is at high risk, and I believe Tillamook is the third one. There's three areas in the coast that are really exposed at this time, so.
Okay, thank you, Representative Mesley. Any further comments?
Questions?
Senator Yee.
I want to know why it is federal funding reduced by about 50%.
50.9%. Okay, Senator Yee, you want staff or?
Well, everything was reduced because
there was a project ongoing that was completed. Having brought that project
closure,
we
authorized the
spending
authority for the
agency.
Okay, Senator Fisher?
Well, that's reiterating all the reasons I want to add my support to the add-back because then that's what it's doing.
Okay. Any further questions, comments, any no votes? Seeing none. Senate Bill 5516. Senate Bill 5524, State Library, Senator Trope.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 5524 is the budget for the State Library. It comes to you with the unanimous approval of your Ways and Means General Government Subcommittee. The State Library is very focused on its mission and has three key goals. One, to help local libraries improve their library services throughout the state. Two, to provide research services to the legislature and the state agencies. And three, to serve visually impaired and disabled Oregonians with Braille materials and recorded books under the Talking Book and Braille Services Program. The approved budget will allow the State Library to continue current services and maintain the ready-to-read program at the 1997-99 level of 75 cents per child. Mr. President, or Mr. Chair, the committee was very interested in that program and hopes that, if possible, that program can be enhanced a bit. We think it's a fine program. The Talking Book and the Braille Service is a program where the federal government provides the tapes, books, and mailing at no charge to the program. The State Library must provide staffing and supplies to store, maintain, and process the books and tapes. This budget adds other funds to support a three-quarters time position in the Talking Book and Braille Service. This position will provide additional help in processing and mailing the books. They mail out over 1,400 books and tapes daily and provide this service using 44% volunteer help. The budget also adds $71,305 and other funds to purchase systems furniture for newly remodeled areas of the State Library. This purchase will better accommodate staff in minimal space.
This is a good budget. Your General Government Committee recommends approval of Senate Bill 5524.
Thank you, Senator Charles. Representative Ross.
Question. How much was the increase for the talking books, Service of the Blind? In terms of the FTE, you stated it.
Staff, please. Staff can help.
What's this position, what it does, if they had the position within their budget before and they've actually shifted the FTE from one program to another program?
And so what is the total FTE allocated?
0.75.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robinson. Representative Schrader.
Yeah, there's a question regarding, was there any discussion in committee on the assessment fees that the State Library charges other agencies?
We did talk about those generally decided that they were okay and didn't make any changes.
Okay, go ahead.
Just a comment. And some of the other budgets, particularly the smaller like health boards and stuff, my impression is the way it was assessed is like on an FTE basis. And some of the smaller boards in particular were hit pretty hard with, a half person or one person FTE increase, which would be like half of their agency. And their assessment would go up very, very dramatically. So I had some real questions about how the...
I think generally we're working on the problem of GAF assessments. Generally, this is one of the GAF assessments to try to handle those. I don't know if Chair Butler wants to comment about that or not.
Go ahead, Tom. I would like to have Katie reference the issue of the assessment because we did go ahead and authorize the modification in the assessment. My recollection is that did he move it? Did we move it?
What was the question, Representative Butler?
I'm trying to remember if we moved the assessment for the State Library that's being assessed for each FTE within the state right now, if we modified that so that it would enhance general funds within the other budget.
If I'm hearing you correctly, you're asking if we did do that?
Yes.
No, the adjustment that we made was on the Attorney General, where we made that reduction on the assessment. The assessments to these agencies are on two bases. One is on an FTE basis and also on usage basis. There's actually two portions to that assessment.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, does that help, Representative Schrader?
Then I'll make a statement. I'm a strong supporter of the library, State Library. My wife's a librarian. But I do have a problem with the way the assessment thing is set up here. So I may just be a token no vote just to raise the awareness level so that we can address this issue in the future.
Okay, thank you. Further comments? Questions? Are there any no votes, Representative Schrader? Okay, any other no votes? They let the record show there's one no vote on Senate Bill 5524, Representative Schrader. State Library budget has passed. Next budget is Senate Bill 5538, Department of Veterans Affairs. Senator Cukup.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 5538 is a budget bill for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and the agency finances home and farm loans for Oregon veterans and provides counseling and claim services, educational benefits, and conservatorship services to veterans, their dependents, and providers. The department operates a skilled nursing care and Alzheimer's disease facility in the Dalles, which opened in November of 97. The subcommittee recommended operating budget is $2,415,136 general fund and $36,730,135 other funds. The budget is 21% higher than $97.99 estimated expenditures due to a phase-in of the new veterans home for its first full biennium, which is operated entirely with other funds. A budget note was added requesting that the department return to the emergency board following the Senior and Disabled Services Division inspection of the home and report on the inspection results. The budget includes improvements to outdated technology, equipment, air conditioning, and carpeting. And just to go back for 1 minute about the department returning to the emergency board, that some of you may know that in the newspaper there was some coverage of
in the Alzheimer's ward there at that home. It, the headline said something about fighting. We were told actually that one of the residents shoved another one of the residents. And my comment was, as often we get big headlines about bad news, and if there really is a change that, they're addressing it right now, and when they come back to give them a clean slate, we as legislators don't hear about that. That's why we suggested they come to the emergency board. The general fund is used to support veteran counseling and claim services and aid programs, including partial funding for county veteran service offices and conservatorship services. The subcommittee reduced the department's general fund by 3% for vacancy savings and approved the package of $23,320 general fund, which will help to maintain the current level of training in county veteran service offices and educational assistance for veterans, and the subcommittee recommends approval.
Thank you, Senator Kuta. Questions, comments? Are there any no votes in the Department of Veterans Affairs budget? Seeing none and seeing none, Senate Bill 5538 is passed. Other bills reported out of subcommittee, House Bill 2619 relating to substitute teachers, Representative Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. House Bill 2619 modifies the method of calculating salaries for substitute teachers in school districts with a salary scale after the 10th consecutive day of substituting for the same teacher. The per diem salary would be the higher of a 1/190th of the employing school district's annual salary for a beginning teacher with a bachelor's degree, or B, 85% of the 1/190th of the statewide average salary for a beginning teacher with a bachelor's degree. Currently, for the first 10 days of substitute work, teachers receive a per diem amount of at least 85% of 1/190th of the statewide average salary for a beginning teacher with a bachelor's degree. The per diem for substitute teaching for more than 10 consecutive days in any one assignment for the same teacher is based on 1/190th of the employee school district's annual salary for a beginning teacher with a bachelor's degree. In some districts, the district's salary is less than 85% of the statewide average salary and results in substitute teachers receiving less pay per day after 10 days in the same assignment. The Education Subcommittee discussed the limited number of school districts affected by this bill and the minimal fiscal impact to those districts. For the 1998-99 school year, this change would have affected only three school districts with an impact of between 18 cents and $2.02 per day. The Education Subcommittee recommends approval of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Minnis. Questions? Representative Schrader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Were there any comments from the school district on this particular proposal?
They had the, you know, that he didn't have any comments. The impact was only affected three school districts, and the most $2.02 per day. What's happening is substitute teachers are working 10 days. After the 10th day, they have to revert back to the lower scale because of the way their budget is set up. With the district, they keep working at the same amount instead of being paid less for working longer.
Okay, Representative Mesler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question of the carrier. Just curious, why we're getting involved in this issue? Why this isn't a local school board issue?
I don't know. It was brought to the Legislative Substitute Teachers Association about it before the bill was introduced.
Mr. Chair, can I help with that question?
Okay.
Senator Tripp, for a long time, the salaries for substitute teachers have been decided here. They don't have collective bargaining, and generally to get some uniformity, they've been asking us to make a decision about their salaries. So it is already in statute, and we've been doing that for as long as I've been in the legislature, every so often, reviewing their salaries and setting a minimum. We don't set the maximum, we set a minimum salary.
We had a bill last session that I think said it was 78 hours a day, wasn't it? 12 we have here.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be
Partridge. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll bring my bus for the rest of my thing. I'll be voting. Because we're doing just the ways and means impact on this, and I assume the policy committee took a look at this, I'll be voting in favor of this. I don't know if I will be voting
in favor of it on the floor. I think we need some cost controls on what's going on with our teachers statewide. We have, we're spending over $4 billion almost on teacher salaries. If we, as looking down the barrel of the K-12 budget, it seems odd to me on one hand that we're hooking it to teacher salaries upon which we have no control of. So that's bothersome to me because we don't have any control over what the initial salary sheet is either. So I'll be voting against that.
Okay.
That's my concern.
Thank you, Representative Patridge. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would only say that I think it's a little misleading to say we don't have control over teacher salary. We have a collective bargaining system in this state that balances the interests of the school districts with teachers, and that process determines what they're paid. And to be opposed to paying a substitute teacher 85% of the beginning salary of a teacher, which is already low, is something I can't find myself doing. These are people that, as I recall, really get no benefits and just simply get a salary. And so I don't mind looking for ways to cut money, but I'd be more interested in some other decisions this legislature has made to generate revenues for schools than I would acquiring substitute teachers who are already working at very minimal salaries to bear the burden of our fiscal problems. So I'll be voting yes.
Okay, thank you, Representative Leonard. For the comments,
Senator Troy?
Representative Leonard got some of what I was going to say. The minimum salary we've set for them is very minimal. A lot of these people have a great deal of experience, and they really are heroes when they come in suddenly to take over for a teacher that can't continue for some reason or another. And they get paid less than the average salary of a beginning teacher. So their salary level, the minimum we set. Now, sometimes they're paid more than the minimum, but not very often. Usually the minimum salary we set is what they're paid. And it's not, it's certainly a modest salary for people who really do an important job.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I was just affirming what Senator Troy was saying, that most school districts do adopt the minimum that is provided for in statute, and that is 85% of the average statewide salary for beginning teachers with a bachelor's degree. And in some cases, in very few cases, there are schools that once those substitute teachers go past 10 days, their beginning salaries on which the pay for over 10 days is calculated falls below 85% of the statewide average, and that's why this bill was introduced, so that they would at least get paid what they get paid for the first 10 days and not take a cut in pay simply because they stay past 10 days.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, can staff clarify for us the benefit issue? My recollection was they do not get benefits due to the no.
That's correct. They do not get the benefit package that a full-time teacher would get.
Okay. Further questions, comments? Are there any no votes on House Bill 2619? Seeing none and hearing none, House Bill 2619 has passed. Budget bills previously reported out, Senate Bill 5520, the Department of Justice, Senator Hinn.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, members, Senate Bill 5520 is the budget bill for the Department of Justice. It's been through this committee once, went to the floor of the Senate and passed, back over to the House, and then was sent back down the Ways and Means. The only action the subcommittee did was to reduce the Department's general fund by $569,898, or a 4% of the total, and then backfilled with other funds' expenditure limitations with a like amount. And the net effect is that they're going to receive money from the tobacco tax settlement legal fees of an estimated $600,000. What this does is allow us to back outside of much our general fund and insert the legal fees collection from the tobacco tax settlement. There is no opposition. The Attorney General supports it. and we would move to send it back out to the House with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Hannon. Any comments? Questions? Are there any no votes on Senate Bill 55?
Amendment as a reasonable accommodation. Senator Shields, in response to the bill, I haven't talked to him since it was drafted, but I talked to him about the concept, would be willing to have the concept adopted if he sees it addressing his issue. So it's in front of you. I'll just ask whether or not anybody wants to move the A4 amendment. Representative Hansen moves adoption of the A4 amendment to Senate Bill 1071. So that amendment is now in front of us. Is there further discussion?
Sure, I just want to read through this one.
Sure. And I'll explain it while you're reading it. It simply says, the objection was that these teams of people that are going out to put up posters telling people that they're camping unlawfully are also issuing citations as they go out and do this. And that was objectionable. The idea of posting the notice was to have the notices posted and then give people 24 hours to clear out.
Right.
This makes it clear that as they're in the area milling about, putting up posters or whatever, within the 2 hours before and after, and 200 feet was just a desire figure to have some sort of general range in that area, they should not be issuing citations at that time and place. There is a possible correction to it because I noticed the trespassing was less than this amendment.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if we're putting the notice up saying it's about 24 hours, but in 2 hours you can get a ticket.
Yeah, this, it's pending, but then I would say that we could deal with a Scrivener's error by agreeing to take out trespassing because that was not the issue at the time. It was unlawful camping.
And that is not what I requested, Mr. Chairman.
So as a friendly Scrivener's error correction, I'd like to have it agreed by consent that we'll still not agree with the amendment, but to clarify this amendment, trespassing or those two words on line 5 are in error and should have been deleted. Be a citation for unlawful camping. That was the issue, not trespassing. Hearing no objection, that correction is made to the A4. The A4 is still in front of us.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm still troubled by, now the 200 feet notice requirement, you can still give somebody a ticket within 2 hours, within 200 feet.
No, they're in the conjunctive. In other words, you... 2 hours before and 2 hours after you're in that spot, and within 200 feet, both of them, you can't be issuing these citations for unlawful camping. Your team that goes, basically, you're going to tell the team that goes out to post these notices, don't issue citations for unlawful camping.
That's my point, Mr. Chair, but at 2 hours and 1 minute, you can issue a citation. I guess the question is, why put up a 24-hour notice if in 2 hours and 1 minute you're going to issue a citation?
I don't think the city's going to spend the money to have the personnel standing around for 2 hours. I would hope they get the drift here. If not, next time we'll make it 24 hours.
The only problem I see is, this, Mr. Chair, from our perspective, is similar to what Representative Bowman said. My concern, when we passed the 95, the 24-hour notice, that was basically to give whoever is in those camps notice, and what if these people, when the notice is posted, are not there, and 2 hours or 3 hours does pass, then are they, it seems to me that they are going to be liable for being cited. That's all I'm...
I agree, and this is an attempt to get at the hot spot. The hot spot issue was teams going out with citation books in hand, putting up posters and issuing citations. Yes, I suppose if they want to get around it, they're going to look at their clock and wait 2 hours and then walk around and issue citations, although they still can't clear the camp for 22 more hours. I would hope that the city of Portland would get the thrust of the idea, which is tell these crews not to issue citations for unlawful camping, get the posters up, and then come back 24 hours later to clear the camp. Now, There's some assumption of good faith. This is a restriction, not an empowerment. And if we don't want to do the restriction, that's okay, too. But that's the amendment right now.
I understand. And, Mr. Chair, I guess from my perspective, what we have in front of us and knowing our haste to move through this as quickly as possible, I guess I would be willing to support one removing the trespassing or and willing to move the bill in a, let's say, forward direction with the reservation that, one, I may change my vote on the floor, and, two, if I don't have an opportunity to talk to Senator Shields before the afternoon.
I understand that. But this bill will not come up again after tomorrow, and we just have a short time frame. And I'm comfortable with the solution, but if other people are not, that's okay.
Mr. Chair, can we ask counsel if this is actually set for on schedule for tomorrow?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanska, I'll have to check. I don't recall. I
might not be. Well, we have... I was even asked by some people why we are bringing this bill back. It is set for tomorrow. There's your answer. Thank you for that. All right, it's set for tomorrow. Right now, we have the A4 amendments in front of us with a correction to take out trespassing or on line 5. I'm going to ask the clerk to call the roll on the motion to adopt the A4 amendments with that further correction.
Aye. I'm going to say aye at this point. I do have some reservations, and but I'm going to move that in the bill. I'm going to ask some procedural matter after the vote.
Aye. Motion carries. The A4 amendments with the correction are adopted. President Hanson, do you move? All right, President Fazan, do you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask that we, I want to say, table this till tomorrow, because it is on the agenda, and for we can pass it up. I would like to speak with Senator Shields. The reason he came to me, we talked about some different language. I understand y'all's discussion may have been after he talked to me.
Well, I had talked to him about the different language, but I've also talked to the city of Portland and law enforcement. They have a lot of trouble with that different language. And this language they don't have trouble with. It still accomplishes its original purpose. But what we'll do is I'll close the work session. It's on the agenda for tomorrow. And so this closes the work session on Senate Bill 1071. The bill stands in front of us and has amended. Next up, Senate Bill 482.
We did that.
Wow.
Maybe we could go to 7:40 in the event that we have to leave.
All right. Well, I'll tell you right now, Senate Bill 506 conflicts with House Bill 2705. Anybody here on Senate Bill 506? Are you aware that it conflicts with House Bill 2705? Sort of.
Why don't you say it?
Do you want us to move on Senate Bill 506? I didn't think so. We will just not do anything with Senate Bill 506. That makes it pretty easy.
2705 wants to be moved out of the Senate committee.
Yes, sir. We will move on to our final item, which is Senate Bill 740. We have the work session on Senate Bill 740. Counsel, where are we?
Mr. Chairman, there are some conflict amendments for the committee. Those are the A5. And those actually have to do with resolving something that the Senate has already passed, which is the private indecency bill. It just has some corrective language in there and does not change the substantive content of Senate Bill 740. And those are the only amendments, I believe, before the committee.
I did have a request about whether or not minor exceptions could be carved out of this, but you probably haven't had time to work on that since yesterday. Yes,
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd ask the same question that I did on the previous bill. Is this set for tomorrow?
Yes.
Well, here's what we'll do. Between now and tomorrow, let's see if those exceptions can be carved up in an LC draft to be presented as to certain juveniles being accepted from this bill, which I'd certainly be open to if we can do that without... And I think you may want to talk to the folks in State Police about that issue. As to certain limited crimes, kidnapping, for example, in the second degree, and how that impacts juveniles, maybe there could be a little conversation this morning. And feel free to check back with me, because this issue came up after I had a meeting with the proponents of the bill. I haven't had a chance to get back to you because of other things. Kathy, if you would speak to the folks from the State Police. I don't know if the Oregon Youth Authority would like to weigh in on that, too. I'd welcome them doing so and ask you to do so. Get word to me as to whether or not some particular amendments might be desirable. We'll have the conference amendments available to us. And with that, this concludes the work session. We'll bring this bill back tomorrow. We're adjourned.